So this passage at first looks like it's a conversation of Solomon's wife encouraging and praising her husband. It might even be sexual in nature if you read it that way. But what we need to do is understand the passage as a whole, see the whole context. And so we talked last week at the beginning part of chapter 5 that Solomon is a workaholic. That he's coming home late, not just a little bit late, but hours and hours late. And the first thing that he wants from his wife as she sleeps is to make love to her. Now, Solomon's wife went from worrying about him to anger and frustration to just a point of bitterness, because it's not the first time that he's worked too much and not kept his word. She rejects him. And that makes sense, because Solomon rejected her first. He chose work over her. It seemed valid to him. He was doing something important. It was their livelihood. It was the nation at stake. But we said last week that neglect is neglect, because God had brought them together and covenanted, and he was supposed to take care of her first. And so neglect is neglect, and he rejected her. And in response, she's indifferent to him, and she rejects him in return. She knows that he's working too much, that he's getting crushed at work, that he's not really succeeding anywhere in life. He comes home and he needs that one place of reprieve, that one oasis to be with his wife, and she's indifferent, rejects him, allowing bitterness to seep down into her heart. And so we're going to spend another week in chapter 5, because rejection kind of balloons into fighting and into conflict, and we as a culture, we're pretty bad at conflict. We have bought in holistically to this me-centered way of thinking and living. It's ethnocentric. It's self-centered. It's my happiness. It's my beliefs. It's my desires. It's what feels good to me. And the moment something doesn't feel good, the moment is that something isn't what you want it to be, you want out of that. Okay? So there's conflict at church. You don't want to be there anymore. There's conflict at work. You think about a different job or a different career. There's conflict in your neighborhood. You might move. There's conflict in your relationships. And you want to begin to tap out of those relationships, even out of marriage because of conflict. There's no strength there. Strength is developed in the midst of relational tension. There's no depth there. There's no depth in the self-centered living. It leaves us as shallow people, and there's no lasting relationship. It leaves us as a lonely group of people. Every one of us is going to have conflict. Every one of us is going to fight sooner or later, and so we need to spend extra time in this passage, because every couple fights. Healthy couples fight clean. Unhealthy couples, they fight dirty. Healthy couples fight for reconciliation when unhealthy couples are coming to fight to win, and ultimately, a healthy couple exposes their character because they treat each other carefully in the midst of conflict, where an unhealthy couple exposes their immaturity as they just fight to tear the other person down so they look better. Now, we get this great opportunity this morning to open up the Bible and watch somebody else fight. Maybe we can learn some stuff. We can learn when to duck, and we can learn when to run, and we can learn when to engage, and we don't have to go through the difficulty of conflict. And so let's jump back in, look at the whole passage of chapter 5, and learn what it is to fight in a godly, biblical way. We'll start with verses 2 and 3 of chapter 5. Here's what it says. I slept, but my heart was awake, a sound. My beloved is knocking, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. She says this, I put off my garment, how could I put it on? I had bathed my feet, how could I spoil it? All right, so my wife and I were in Charleston the last couple of days. We were talking to church planters and speaking at a conference, and we were staying in this little room on a pretty busy street. And at 2:45 on Friday morning in the a.m. hours, I heard this. I just don't know what I mean to you anymore. Just over and over, I don't know what I mean to you. And I thought, am I saying that? Am I like dreaming and talking out loud? And no, it wasn't me. And I looked over to Kimberly, and she was asleep. And then just over and over, this guy is just heartbroken. I mean, it's the dude just weeping. I just don't know what I mean to you anymore. And there was this couple sitting right outside of our window on the wall of our house fighting with each other. And in the first 4 or 5 minutes, man, my heart just went out to this guy. I mean, he's crushed and he's heartbroken, and I'm so sorry for him. But about minute 5, it started to change a little bit. It's 2:45 in the morning. Walk away is what I started to think, you know? And then after 10 minutes and 12 minutes, and then at about 15 minutes, I was possessed. And I got up and I went out onto the porch, and I didn't mean to, but I sounded like a goat screaming like a human. Just, ah! Just They jumped like 8 feet. They thought they were startled before. And when that happened, I mean, they were just shocked. And I think I just said, walk away. Like, run away, retreat, run for your lives, go somewhere else. This is terrible, you know? No compassion at all. Why? It's kind of embarrassing to watch somebody else fight, isn't it? That's what we get to see today. We get to see Solomon and his wife fight about being a workaholic, fight about intimacy, and try to bring some resolution to it. Conflict for you is inevitable. And if you fight cheap, you're going to live in your home always on guard. It's never a good thing. If you're on guard constantly and you're locked and loaded because you get lit up by your spouse, you're going to go into a place where you just want to light them up as well. And that's a miserable place to live. If you're constantly tearing each other down, you're withering on the inside and they're withering on the inside. And you get this very cold place that's not tender and that's not merciful at all. And sooner or later, all you want to do is win. I want to win. And if you win in your marriage, ultimately, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. Okay, so a very practical analogy that I think is helpful, and I want to use it kind of as the thread that weaves together through this conversation, is go home this week and do your relational yard work. Yard work is the right understanding. If you do yard work every week for 30 minutes to an hour, depending on your yard's going to look nice. It's not going to look like the horror film house that you walk by. It's easy. You can enjoy it. It's nice. But if you wait once a year to do yard work, it's almost impossible to get it done. The weeds are over your head. There's vines everywhere. The trees are overgrown. You can work for hours and hours, turn around, and it looks like you've done nothing at all. If you'll begin to work on things that cause conflict in your life, in your marriage especially, and get into it for 30 minutes, an hour, or a week, and begin to bring resolution to those, your marriage is going to be a lot more healthy, and it's going to be easier for you. And so here's what I want to do as we talk about fighting. A survey was done a few years ago, asked the question what most couples fight about, and it came back there are 5 major areas that couples and relationships find conflict. Money, communication, your crazy in-laws, spirituality, and then finally number 5, sexuality. Now, the survey says the number one thing that couples fight about is money, but I humbly want to disagree. And if you disagree with me, that's fine. Write your own sermon. You have all the freedom to do that whenever you want to. I think the real issue is communication. You're not finding middle ground. You're not compromising. You're not sacrificing. So it's communication ultimately. So let's start with communication. There are many things that inform your communication patterns. For example, your gender informs the way that you communicate. In the past, I've used this study that women on average use 20,000 words per day and men only use 10,000 words per day. But the most recent studies are women use 13,000 more words a day than men do. And so there really is a difference between men and women, even if we don't want to say there is. That's one thing that informs it. Being an external processor versus being an internal processor changes it. Your personality type changes your communication. Your phase of life does. There can be times that you're so tired because you're just getting through school, you just had kids. Somebody asks you a question and you're just like, nope, I'm going to sleep because you're so tired. It's a phase of life. All of this communicates and develops the way that you speak. Now, here's the most important thing that I could say about communication. It's really important to know what your style is, but it's far more important to know what your spouse's style is. Studies have been done. The major patterns of communication, they fall down into 4. It's somewhat stereotypical, but I think you'll identify immediately to which one you are. Here are those 4 styles. You really need to know yours, and even more important, to know your friends and your spouse. Number 1 is general conversation. Number 2 is reporting of facts. Number 3 is ideas and judgments. Number 4 is feelings and emotion. Now, my wife is a storyteller. And she does it persuasively. When she tells me about her day, I was literally there with her when the story is done. I was there at sunrise and I know what it looked like. I was there during the shower. I was there when the kids exploded. And then at 5:45, right before I came in, I was there. It's like she used persuasive writing verbally with me. And it paints this fantastical picture. And I'm just amazed. I, on the other hand, report facts. At 8:30, I started. At 12:30, I went to lunch. At 5:30, I came home. And 4 seconds later, I am done communicating entirely. It's different. And so what usually happens in couples is you demand that your spouse begins to communicate in the manner in which you communicate, right? So external processors want you to be an external processor. Talk more, be verbose, get stuff out. While the internal processor is thinking to himself, you're just making stuff up, to the external processor. You're not bought into this. You're just kind of tagging things together. This is ridiculous. Or introverts want extroverts to be like them, because extroverts are walking around more, and the introvert's like, all done, dunsies, right? And so you want stories if you're a storyteller. You want facts if you're a fact teller. But the reality is this. You can't change the way that your spouse communicates. Kimberly can't change the way that I communicate. What she has to do is create space for me to be able to download more of my day to her. She needs to know I want to tell her. And so she doesn't demand that I communicate like her in storytelling. She's become an expert at asking questions so she can know more about my day. You're going to have to learn to listen and not try to change the way that they communicate. Kimberly tells stories. What that means for me is I have to go home and at 5:45 create 10 minutes where the kids aren't raging in chaos and let my wife tell the story, tell the day. I want to know. It's important to her. Now, sometimes she starts this way. A really tragic thing happened. It started 4 months ago. And I have to be like, time out. I need the end of the story first. She'll tell me the end and then I'll give her the space to go back and to fill out the rest of the story. And so it's really important to understand your spouse is hardwired the way that they communicate. They've been communicating that way since they could talk, and you need to change the way that you listen and not the way that they begin to communicate at all. And in conflict, because that's what we're talking about, the most important thing that you can remember when you're having a fight with your spouse or your friends is to be slow to speak and quick to listen. External processors, bite your tongue. Internal processors, bite your tongue. Be very slow and be very tender and be very careful and don't say the first thing or the 10th thing that comes to your mind. Allow Jesus to calm that heart and settle you and then begin to speak to those people. And so part of your yard work this week, I hope, is that you would go home and ask your friends and your spouse, where is our communication currently breaking down in our relationship? And that would spark some conversation. And if that doesn't spark enough, I have a great communication questionnaire, and I would love to email that to you so you can have more questions to ask each other. My email address is tyler@vintagenc.com, and I would love for you to begin to have that conversation. Now, communication is the first issue. The second thing that causes massive conflict is money. Money cannot make you happy, but it can absolutely make you miserable. And just like there's different styles of communication, there's differing views of how you see money and how you spend money. And you need to begin to understand the perspective of your spouse and your friends. And so here's the questions for your yard work. Here's what I want you to take home. The first question is this. Now, list in order of importance five areas where you currently should be spending your money. So you do it, and then you have your spouse do it at the same time, and you do it separate. Now, that's question one. And then question two and three is a great exercise. If somebody gave you $10,000, list the five ways that you would spend that money. And then write out the five ways that you think your spouse would spend that money. Each of you do that and then come together and talk to each other. And you're going to get yourself in a lot of trouble. It's going to be full of tension and it's going to be awkward. I can't believe you put that as number three. You think that about me? I'm not that shallow. And I like awkward things. And so I can't wait. I want to hear about the tension, okay? I wish I could be there because that's my favorite type of humor, just being awkward. It's going to be awkward for you. And know this, you're both wrong. I know, you're both wrong. Some of you are predisposed to spend too much. And it's going to get you in a lot of trouble and you have a lot of debt and it's going to bring a lot of conflict into your marriage. And some of you are predisposed to save too much. And you can absolutely be too frugal. I could tell you story after story where one person mandates saving too much, changes life patterns, forces them to live an hour and a half from their job. And it breaks the goodness and the depth of their marriage. And so you're going to have to make sure that you come together and you merge. The core concept of marriage is one word. It's humility. And humility hits the reality of your marriage most when it comes to finances. Let me try to prove it to you. Biblically, who's responsible for the finances of the family? The man is, right? No. I wish you could have seen the tension there. That was really awkward with you guys. That's hilarious to me to see that tension build up. Like you were angry. I tricked you. It's the woman. No, it's not. It's the couple. The couple's supposed to sit down and spend time speaking about the tool of money and how they're going to use money. Sometimes it comes really easy because you have the same view and the same styles of life, and sometimes it's really hard. And it takes days, especially in your first part of your marriage, or if you've had bad patterns for years, or weeks or months, and you have to pray, and the man has to die to himself, and the woman has to relent to make the couple more important than the individuals, and sometimes you have to seek help and talk to financial advisors and other people that you trust, and you come to commonality, and you agree together because it's challenging. And you don't want a tool like a hammer to cause conflict in your marriage, and that's all money really is, right? So there's 100 different ways for you to manage your money. Let me just humbly suggest a couple of really important points. Number one, make sure you have one bank account. And that's contrary to a lot of people's wisdom today. You're one spiritually if you're married. You're one physically. You're one relationally. And you shouldn't be two financially. You shouldn't do anything that would plan for a time that you're going to be separate because you've made its covenant in the presence of God and God can redeem all things. And if you put it in one pot and you don't see it as his money or her money, but our money, that brings a lot of humility into it. If I need new clothes, do you know what I do? I go to my wife and I say, I need new clothes, sweetheart. Will you take me to buy some new clothes? That's humility. And then when she buys me new clothes, I thank her for taking care of me because it's not my money, it's our money. And she was gracious towards me and it develops humility. Develops some humility, have one account and treat each other with respect. And then if you're going to develop some humility, one person needs to balance the checkbook and make sure that bills are getting paid. Because if you don't, both of you might pay the mortgage one month and you don't have any money left over for noodles. Or both of you forgets to pay the mortgage and then you're living in a tent down by the river, right? And we don't even have a river in Raleigh or Durham, and that's really complex. And so what you need to do is have one person taking care of it. And then when I do that, because that's how our home works, I'm a little bit better with numbers. My wife is exceedingly frugal. There are months that I get to say, sweetheart, we have a little bit more money. This and this can happen. Or there are months where it's really tight. And could we just shave everything off right now? And she trusts me in that. And then she always gets the trump card. She always gets that. Show me. Great, sweetie. I would love to show you. I know you're not questioning me. I know you're not coming against me. I know you love me. You have all the right to see everything. Let's sit down after the kids have dinner and are in bed, and let's just talk through money. Okay, that's humility. And then finally, in humility, as you manage your money, if you have any hope to escape materialism and envy and greed, you need to give a portion of your money away, and it needs to be large enough to where it actually changes the way that you live. All you've ever seen with your money, a lot of us at least, is the feeding of our own materialistic desires, the accomplishment of our own goals, and the creating of our own realms of safety. You need to see your money redeem something. You need to see your money advance something. You need to see your money change somebody's life. And when you see that and you respond to the generosity of Jesus and you're generous in response, then this money becomes a tool and it becomes a beautiful thing in your marriage, creating generosity around you instead of trying to make you hoard stuff and be absolutely materialistic. So money's a big deal, and you should go home and begin to talk about these things. Number three, your family and your crazy in-laws who are your family, right? You get that, right? It's your family that's the crazy in-laws. Here's the important parts about dealing with family as you get married. Number one, always protect your spouse from your mom and your dad. Don't you dare pick up the phone and belittle and gossip and speak negatively about your husband or your wife. What you do when you do that is you pit your husband against your mom, you pit your wife against your mom and your dad. You're creating a storm in your relationship and you're living in chaos and it's your own fault. It's not theirs, it's yours. The Bible's really clear. When you get married, you leave your mom and dad and you cleave to your husband. There's this cleaving to your wife that happens. You cleave to them. Right? Don't ever come to a place where you choose your mom or your dad over your husband or your wife. Right? Some of you are mama's boys and you're 25 and 35 years old and you think it's a good idea to pack your family up and move to your hometown so you can be close to your mom and your high school friends. That's a terrible idea. It's a terrible idea. You need instead to cleave to your wife, learn and grow. Find her as your place of reprieve. For some of you as women, you still find the greatest consolation, the greatest peace, the greatest mercy with your mom and your dad, and that relationship can be vibrant and rich and good and deep. But it's your husband, it's your wife to whom you cling to. For some of us, the best thing that we could do is to have less time with our mom and our dad and begin to learn to be in relationship with our husband and our wives. If you're a parent and you're 45 or 55 or 65 and you're still creating patterns of dependency with your married son or daughter, today's got to be the day that that stops. You're messing with an oriented covenant ordained by God, and that's really important for us to hear. Okay? So when you get to leaving the cleaving part together, then you face each other. And this is the most horrifying thing that you'll learn about your in-laws and your family. Even if you have great parents, they're messed up. Do you know what the primary coping mechanism of an adult is when that adult is under stress? You do exactly what your parents did. It's subconscious. You don't even know it. It's a default mechanism, right? And so you said your whole life, I'll never be like my mom. I'll never do what my dad did. And the moment that marriage is stressor, your job becomes overwhelming, your kids are crushing you, you do exactly what your parents did. And then you say, I can't believe what I'm doing, right? Just as plain as I can. If your parents manipulated, you will manipulate as an adult unless you make a conscious decision to stop manipulating. You have to see it in your parents and break the pattern. If your parents fought ruthlessly, you will fight ruthlessly unless you intentionally break that pattern. So you need to go home and you need to begin to learn to leave and cleave, and you need to point out very graciously, probably about your own family and not your spouse's family, some patterns that you see and begin to stand up to those and make definitive statements against those and work against those. Number four, spirituality. This seems dogmatic and strong at first, and I don't mean it. It's actually the most gracious thing, I believe. At Vintage, we'll marry doubters with doubters, doubters with seekers, seekers with doubters, seekers with seekers. We'll marry followers to followers, but we won't marry followers to doubters or seekers. Here's why. Following Jesus is not a religion. Following Jesus is not a statement of dogma that you adhere to, and it's a philosophical statement of life. Following Jesus is a relationship based in love to a real living God, and Jesus informs everything about our life. He informs how we see money and use money. He informs how we deal with our children and what that looks like, how we raise our children. He informs all about our life. And so if your spouse is in a different place, we love that person, we care for that person, but your lives are going in different directions, at different rates, different trajectories. And so either that means you're going apart from each other at an alarming pace, or you're barreling down towards each other, not to meet in the middle, but for a head-on collision. And so we're not doubting your commitment, we're doubting your love, we're not doubting your ability to have resolve. We just want you to properly understand, as you date somebody and engage somebody, that your total life understanding is different directions. And we don't want either for you to walk away from faith because we didn't have the courage to love you enough to say this is a big deal. And so we want to stop and pause in the midst of that and say, would you pray? Would you be thoughtful? We love you and your potential spouse, and we want to walk with you. And so that causes big issues in marriages. You get married and you realize that you're going in totally different directions. If you're in that place, there's great hope for you. We can walk with you and have that conversation with you. You should stay married. God wants you married, and so you should stay there, and we learn to work about it together. And then finally, number five that causes conflict in marriage is sexuality. We've talked about sex a lot in this series. We have a few more conversations to have in the coming weeks, and so I won't say much. I'll just say this. Sex is a force of nature. It absolutely is. It's like the sun in the sky. If you wrongly engage with the sun, it burns and cracks and causes cancer. And so a lot of us have cancer in our lives because we have overwhelming sexual addictions. We've wrongly engaged with a very potent force, and there's healing and hope for you. But also, on the other end, if you have no sun at all in your life, you've taken a plant, you put it into a dark closet, and you leave it in that closet for a couple of months, and you pull it out, it's no longer vibrant and green. It's like pale and placid and see-through and even whitish. It's lost all of its chloroform, right? And so if you're married and you're lacking this intimacy, you're lacking this connection and this tenderness, it's having very negative effects because of the potency and the power of what it's supposed to do in your life. And so if you're on either end of the extreme, it's okay to be there today, but would you be brave enough and courageous enough and deep enough to seek help? My wife and I have needed help before, and we'll need help again. Walk with us, and let us walk with you and find some manner of help. Go home this week. Do your yard work in these five areas and see what God might do. Okay, so they have this major fight, and then Solomon's wife goes to her friends to have conversation. Is that a good idea? I mean, just think about going to your friends. Is it a good idea? Here's what happens in verse 9. Her friends ask her this: "What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us?" I have seen godly women and godly men who have been redeemed by Jesus and reconciled to the Father get together with other women and other men and act like flocks of chickens, picking and attacking and ultimately having a rooster fight, destroying each other in the name of empathy, in the name of sharing sin, in the name of praying for each other. I've seen women get together with each other and their husbands have made a pretty big mistake. And instead of trying to seek reconciliation, their advice to each other is gossip and meddling and destruction and digging in deeper. How much better would it be not to have friends like that at all? Here's what Solomon says in Proverbs chapter 10, verses 19 through 21. "When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. The tongue of the righteous is choice silver. The heart of the wicked is of little worth. The lips of the righteous feed many, but fools die of lack of sense." I've seen men gather together, and they have chosen to call their wives prostitutes or some other word like that. They have chosen to blow them out with expletives that just crush them and ruin them and give each other advice of divorce and of finding another woman. Do you understand the stupidity of that? Do you understand the foolishness of that? Lord, save us from being friends like that. Save us from anything like that at all. Do you not understand that we're engaging in the covenant, not primarily made between a man and a woman, but primarily made between a couple and God himself? And if we're going to go in there and intervene with something that God wanted and God ordained and God said should last, then we have to understand the weight of what we're doing and what we're saying. Interestingly enough, in the New Testament, gossip is one of the things that Jesus and all of the other writers come against with the most strength. Few of us here would believe this today, but the New Testament points in this direction. That gossip is worse than the thing that you're gossiping about. No matter what the action was, gossip is actually worse. You're committing a deeper sin, a more broken thing by gossiping, right? In the New Testament, it puts idolaters and adulterers and haters and angry folks in one category, and then gossipers are put into a totally different category with God haters. Save us from the corrosive nature of gossip. Let us not be like that. Let us be instead like Solomon's wife's friends. They say, "What was it that brought you together? What was it that God showed you about his character that brought you into a place where you had life instead of brokenness?" Right? They realize that their role, even at great cost, was to reconcile the relationship and not tear it apart on any more level. Here's what we believe as a church. Jesus can reconcile and redeem anything. He can redeem any act of affair. He can restore any abuse. He can heal any hatred. He can restore any gossip. And so no matter what has happened in your marriage, God has the capacity to overcome that. And when you gather together with your friends who know Jesus, and you can point each other to Jesus, there's always hope. There's always hope for you and for your relationship, right? Because Jesus is never weary of your marriage. There's never going to be a day where Jesus looks at your marriage and says, "I can't fix that." No, he's never weary. There's not a weary bone in his body. He's able and he's capable to restore, right? He'll restore you with love. He knows when you've been the one transgressed against. He knows when you're the one who's been beaten and broken down, and he loves you, and like a little daughter, a little son, he's going to pick you up when you're hurting. He's going to take care of you, and he knows. He knows when you're the one who's committed the affair, who's committed the atrocity, who's done the sinning, and he'll be strong with you, as a good daddy is with a little boy, to bend that little boy back into health and back into hope and back into godliness. He'll rebuke you a little bit, but ultimately to restore and to affirm you. He'll never grow weary of you ever. If you're a follower of Jesus and you have friendships and you have community and you're not bringing the hope of Jesus into the center of that community, into the center of that friendship, you might as well be stealing that person's stuff and slapping their kids. I mean, really. It's the worst thing that you could possibly do. You have the great hope of the ends of the earth and you keep your mouth closed. Bring Jesus in. He's the hope of the world. And let that hope shine down in on those marriages and change those things. And if you're new here, or if you've been here for a while and you don't have those friendships and you don't have that community, it's really important to us. We want to be a welcoming place where it's easy for you to belong, and there's been times where it's been really hard for you to find that. We're trying everything that we can to create space and to create community groups and to create relationships that are warm, like the summer ocean, and you can get in and enjoy, right? We're trying hard. Try hard with us. Right, community is always a mutual step where you're taking a step towards us and we are stepping towards you. And if you don't yet have that community, do whatever it takes to find that community in this place. We want that for you. We'll help you with whatever we can to develop that community in your life. It's really important to have spiritual friends like this that you can point each other to and know that Jesus really can help you and save you. Okay, so there's significant conflict. Her friends ask her the question, what is it about him that is so lovely and so right and so good? And she begins to list it off. And we'll finish our time by seeing the resolution of the conflict. We'll finish right on time. Go with me in the last few verses. It's the larger section, but it's just a few minute conversation. Here's what it says in verses 10 through 16. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. His arms are rods of gold set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set on bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is sweet, most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Okay, so here's what the Bible does. It didn't have video. It didn't have pictures that you could show images. So what the Bible does often is use descriptive terms to communicate facts and facts about character. We see this in the New Testament in Revelation chapter 1, where John sees a picture of the resurrected Jesus Christ. And John looks at Jesus and says, Jesus' hair is white as wool. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus is this old figure that has really white hair. White hair was a sign of wisdom. And so John is saying Jesus has all wisdom. He's teaching about the character of Jesus. And then he goes on to say that Jesus' feet are like bronze refined in fire. That's not saying that Jesus is some animatronic robot with clunky metal legs. It's saying that his foundation is firm. It's not clay that will just fracture. It's not wood that will rot. He is our firm foundation for the rest of eternity. That's what Solomon's wife is doing here. She says that his eyes are like doves. And we said a few weeks ago that doves are the only faithful animal. And so she's saying he's faithful. She says that his head is like gold. His intentions are good. His thoughts are good. His legs are like columns, meaning that he has safety and security. And then in the last verse, it says this. His mouth is sweet, meaning he's speaking sweetly and tenderly to her. They're fighting, and he's being sweet and tender to her. And so we end with that. How do we speak sweetly and tenderly to each other? I want the last 4 minutes to be like a firework finale, right? Lots of fireworks going off, lots of noise, lots of excitement, and then it's done very quickly, okay? So 10 things, the firework finale of how to speak sweetly to each other. Thing number one, never speak recklessly to each other. Verbal abuse never goes away. You remember the rest of the days of your life, what your wife said about you, what your husband said about you. They can ask for forgiveness. You can extend it to them, but they'll always remember what you said. We've had friends like this, and it's unbelievable to see how they wither in the midst of that pressure. Don't be reckless. Be exceedingly slow to speak and very quick to listen. Don't be reckless. Number two, never confront in public. If you do, it embarrasses them. I want you to feel embarrassment just for a moment, okay? The TV show Family Feud. Have you ever seen that show? The concept is they ask the general population questions, and you give answers according to the general population, not your family. So this woman comes up on the front of Family Feud, and they ask this woman, if you could change any one thing about your husband's body, what would that thing be? She slaps a buzzer, and she says the thing that you can't say. She could say the nose, the eyes, the ears, the Adam apples, the elbows, the knees, the stomach. You could say anything, but you can't say this thing. And she said that thing. And Steve Harvey just was like almost crying that she had just said this, so embarrassed, just went on and on. And the poor guy's over there just melting for the rest of his life. He's going to be known as the one whose wife on national television said the thing that must not be said. Do you feel the embarrassment there? You should. When you confront your spouse in public, that's immediately the embarrassment that they feel. You're the safe place. You're the oasis. You're Ann Getty. You hold their heart, and you just ridicule them publicly. Don't do it. It crushes them. And if you ever do that, confess immediately in front of everybody. We were at dinner one time with 10 people, maybe 12, and I accidentally fumbled through a sentence, and I could tell it embarrassed Kimberly, and I saw it immediately, and I stopped the dinner, and I said, hey, I just embarrassed my wife. What I said I didn't mean to say, and it wasn't true. Sweetheart, you're amazing and beautiful and wonderful, and I'm so sorry. If you rebuke in public, man, you better just confess right there and shore that thing up. Number three, never fight in front of your kids. Your kids need to see conflict. They need to see reconciliation. They need to see real struggle, but they don't need to see intense fights. They don't have that filter. They can't tell it all if you guys are really after each other, and so don't do that at all. Go into another room, go outside, wait till later if you're really intense. Be a grown-up, have the relational strength to not fight in front of your kids. Number four, never use your kids, right? Never be in the car and your wife's still upstairs getting ready and the three kids are in the back and say, she's always late. Don't ever do that. Don't be in the car and say, daddy blew it again. And he always blows it. And I can't believe he did this again. This is the same thing he always does. Don't do that. Don't use your kids against your spouse. If you're in the car with your kids and your wife is late, you tell your kids, mommy's amazing, and I can't believe how much she does for this family and how much she sacrifices. We're going to look out the window and count grass. That's a good decision instead. And if your husband blows it, you don't mock him in front of your kids. You say this, daddy needs grace like mommy does, and mommy blows it all the time. And I'm so glad that Jesus is greater than me and can forgive. That's what we do instead. And that develops a gospel-centered family that changes it. Number five, never say never and never say always. Don't ever do it. If you want to fight, say never and always. And if you do, you'll come home and your pants are going to be in the front yard because you just got kicked out. Never and always are like gasoline on a bonfire. You make your spouse in an indefensible place and all they need to do is lash out and to attack you back. Get rid of never and always from your vernacular and your fights will begin to change. Number six, never get historical. Never do this. Never say January the 18th. You're supposed to be like, what? December the 25th. I'm confused. Is Christmas now January the 18th? No, November the 12th. What are you talking about? All the times that you forgot me, you've blown it, you didn't take care of me, you didn't pursue me. Don't ever get historical. Don't ever keep lists. If you have lists, you have a bitter, cynical heart. And I guarantee you, you hate yourself more than you hate your spouse. And I don't want that for you. Jesus adores you. He doesn't hate you, he loves you. You're his daughter, and you're his son. And he's done all things to make you right with him. And he wants self-hatred to be eradicated from your life. So you need to understand the greatness of Jesus more. And we as the church, that's our job. That's our role. This is Jesus. Look how good he is. Don't hate yourself anymore. One of the ways that you can know it is how you attack your spouse, especially if you keep these lists. You're just conjuring up the day to pull the pin on the grenade and just blow them up. So don't do that anymore. Number seven, talk sweetly about how you feel to them. Have pet names. Say it to them in front of other people. Have phrases that only you and your spouse understand. Say it publicly and people are like, wait a minute, I know what just happened. You guys are dirty. Say stuff like that, right? Text them. Chat with them. Let them know that you adore them and you love them. Just surprise them out of the blue. Speak sweetly to them. Tell them how your heart feels. You have no idea. No idea how good it is for somebody when you turn your heart and the tenderness of your soul shines on them. If you've been in a cold, icy relationship for a long time, be the first person to begin to speak sweetly to them. Touch their arm, hold them close. They'll begin to thaw out and your marriage will begin to turn the corner. Number 8, never call names. Never call names. I can't believe how often I hear men call their wives the word that rhymes with witch. And I almost blew that in the first series. I almost got that backwards in the first service. Or how many times I've heard wives call their husbands idiots. Don't do that. It never goes away. My wife thinks I'm an idiot. It begins to erode your marriage. Number 9, when you're upset and frustrated, don't text, don't chat, don't email anything about the conflict. It's not going to go well. Even if you intend it to go well, sometimes you get that text and you misread it and you think, oh no, she didn't. And you text something back and you light her up and then just went from sweet to dirty and ugly. You walk into the room, you put your hands in your pocket, you lower your shoulders, you relax and you say, I love you, this is hard, and we're going to work this out. And then finally, number 10, don't ever win a fight. Don't ever win. Better to suck up your pride, lose the fight, win the marriage. If you win the fight, you lose the marriage. It might take 5 years, it might take 15 years, but you are establishing your arrogance and your pride. You're demanding that they cower before you. Don't win. Lose. Better to lose the fight and win the marriage. Please go home and do your yard work. If you're married, use this to spark conversation. If you have friendship, these things are rooted right in the midst of all your friendship. Have these conversations. And certainly if you're dating or you're engaged, begin to have these conversations and work them out. How good it is that God looks at every part of your life and says, spirituality matters, relationship matters, fighting matters, money matters, communication matters, sex matters, it all matters. He's good enough and big enough for all of us. Let's pray. God, thanks that you're here with us. We ask that you would do work that only you can do, Lord. I'm so thankful that your love is steadfast. It's not based on our actions. It's not based on our brokenness. It's not based on how we're failing. It's not based on how we're succeeding. You look at us and say, I love my daughters and I love my sons and you belong to me. Lord, let us belong to you this morning. For us that are doubters and seekers, would you work in our lives that would do something that would show us that you're real? Pull back those curtains in our mind and let the light of the world shine in. If it doesn't happen for 50 years, God, that's okay, but walk with them and speak to them and make their hearts tender. Call their names and help them believe in the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. Simple belief brings faith because of grace. God, let us believe. And God, for us, no matter what's happened in our relationships, in our family life, in our friend life, in our married life, you can redeem all things. God, begin as we worship here in response to redeem us. God, heal marriages, change single men and women, restore family relationships. Let abuse fade away. Let healing rise up. Let fighting and arrogance settle down and let reconciliation win. Redeem, renew, triumph, Lord. We love you. We believe that you can do these things. It's in Jesus' great name that we pray. Amen.